Welcome to Coast AM, the very best in late night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. And tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you live from my home studio in Old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. Coming up in the first half of the program, a professor of history and an author delves into a short history of secret societies. A secret society is a society whose membership, teachings, or proceedings are secret, concealed from non-members or otherwise open to the general public. Secret societies accept new members only through initiation rituals, which bind the initiate by various oaths not to reveal the secrets of the society to non-members. The initiations are sometimes multiplied so that there are a variety or degrees or additional credentials that the members can achieve or progress through. These may take the form of an inner circle or group of adepts, or the elect sharing of further secrets that are not communicated to other members. Secret handshakes, passwords, and other symbols are taught to the initiates to enable them to be recognized by others without giving away, well, the secret. We'll discuss some of the myths and legends surrounding secret societies, how they actually date back to prehistoric times. We'll discuss the six different types of secret societies and how they transmit secret messages through the media using coded texts and pictures. From the Order of Assassins to the Knights of the Apocalypse, and the Society of the Leopard, an ancient secret society of men from West Africa that reportedly hunts humans. The Knights Templar, the Black Hand, the KKK, the Illuminati, and of course, the Freemasons. I actually tried to get into a Freemason meeting one time. A friend gave me the secret password. I walked up to the front door of the Masonic Temple, knocked on the door, a little sliding window opened in the door, and the voice on the other side of the door asked for the password. I gave it to him. He said, "Sorry, we changed the password. The new one contains an uppercase letter, two lowercase letters, and a number." There you go, a little Masonic humor to get things rolling. Coming up in the second half, it's Friday night. That means 2 hours of open lines. Before we get to all that, another Friday night tradition that I enjoy immensely, a chat with the news editor for the Coast to Coast AM website, a curator of high strangeness and a sublime scoundrel of the paranormal, and of course, host of Banal of America, the one and only Tim Banal. Tim, how are you?
Hey, Richard, good to talk to you again.
You and I have a friendly rivalry regarding our prospective hometown baseball teams. You're a Boston Red Sox fan. I'm a Blue Jays fan. Your Sox are flying high. You beat Cleveland tonight, and we lost a close one to the Tigers. We're kind of on the downslide.
Yeah, it could go either way right now. We're a little nervous here in Boston, but it's been a fun summer. Anytime they're in contention, it's fun to watch them.
Absolutely. All right. So I want to talk to you about a story that's quite close to home right here in a Toronto suburb, a Mr. Peanut balloon that was mistaken for a UFO. Tell me about this.
Yeah. I had this on the list tonight just for you. I knew this one. We rarely often get stories that are in your neck of the woods, but last Saturday over the city of, let's see if I can get this one right, Mississauga,
yes.
Ah, there you go. Pretty close. Mississauga, which is near Toronto. It's a suburb of Toronto. A person there filmed this strange object in the sky, and it was. I can't quite. Well, we know what it was, right? So, but when you were looking at it, a testament to sort of the nebulousness of UFO videos. It looked like some people thought a flying humanoid, someone on a jetpack. Someone said some kind of ghostly dark spirits, and of course, an alien ship is among the theories. And it made it the rounds on the various YouTube channels that showcase these UFO videos. But it was a short-lived mystery because someone who lives in the area, a man by the name of Alvin Akiaten, shared a picture taken that day of the UFO in question, a much clearer picture, and it was indeed a Mr. Peanut balloon. And that's in the number two spot at the Coast website. Folks can click on that and see the Mr. Peanut balloon in the sky over Mississauga. And I guess if you were far away, you had a bad camera, I could see how you'd be kind of wondering what exactly that thing was.
Right. Although I'm not sure the gray aliens are flying around in a craft that comes complete with a top hat and a monocle.
No, I do not believe so, no.
A little known fact, I think Mississauga, I believe, is the headquarters headquarters for Mr. Peanut are located in the city of Mississauga. And their tagline used to be, and I'm not editorializing on ufologists by any stretch here, but their tagline is, "We know our nuts."
Well, there you go. There you go. Yeah.
All right.
I was excited when I saw that story, because I'm like, this is Richard Surrett country.
There you go. Yes. It's just a short drive from where I'm sitting. Absolutely. Now, this one's a little grisly. You've got some video here up on the coasttocoastam.com website. It's a giant tortoise, which I always thought were vegetarians. Mm-hmm. And it's been spotted hunting and eating, yikes, a baby bird, Tim.
Yeah, this was really remarkable. This is, as I said in our roundup today that we posted to the Coast website, it's, you know, the animal kingdom never stops surprising us, right? So on this island, Frigate Island, which is part of the Seychelles archipelago in the Indian Ocean, has a sizable giant tortoise population. And, you know, they keep an eye on them, they watch them, conservationists, that kind of thing. And they were amazed. This is the first time ever that anyone's ever seen this behavior from a giant tortoise, and they managed to capture it on film. And yet, it's a little bit grisly. Actually, I've seen some clips. The one we share is not as bad as the one that shows the turtle really chowing down on the bird. But it's amazing to see because it's a giant tortoise. It's very slow, as folks can imagine, I'm sure. And what is the bird? A tern chick. And apparently it had fallen out of a tree. And I guess these birds, these baby birds, they don't, they will do anything not to actually touch the ground. I guess they play an everlasting game of lava, right? So it's on a log, and the turtle apparently knows that it's in this predicament and slowly stalks over to the bird and hunts it down. And it's really remarkable. It's one of those things, when I saw sort of it circulating online, I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is not real. This is some kind of a fluke or once in a life. Well, it was once in a lifetime, first time they'd seen it. But, you know, I was kind of like, this is not quite right. But no, this is a natural moment that happened. And now experts are kind of wondering, was this just a one-off moment, or is this population of tortoises on the island, are they developing this new kind of behavior in order to adapt maybe to a reduced food supply? It's very, very interesting. And as they pointed out, you know, the tortoise usually eats grass, which, as we all know, it does not put up a fight, right? apparently it must really want to eat these birds, because otherwise it wouldn't go through all the work of stalking them down and eating them. I would just sit there and eat the grass, right?
Precisely. Wow, it's a little grisly, but also fascinating at the same time. All right, we got to talk about this North Korean defector who has a rather fascinating perspective on UFOs and ETs.
Yeah. Now, I ran this one last week at the Coast website, but it wasn't on the show last Friday, and it really blew my mind. I put it sort of in my pocket for when I came on tonight. Now, normally I try to do sort of some lighthearted stuff. This one was kind of just one that really, really amazed me. Now, you've been around a long time in this field. I've been around a long time in this field, Richard. And it never really crossed my mind. What do North Koreans think of UFOs and aliens? So as luck would have it, there's a website, NK News, that runs a column called Ask a North Korean. And they pose these questions to defectors who had fled the country. And they sort of give insight into what life is like in the hermit kingdom, as they call it. So Hyung Sung Lee, he fled the country in 2014. He was asked this question: what do North Koreans think of aliens and extraterrestrials? And he explained that the state-run television over there, they only occasionally screen documentaries that have UFO elements to them. And the folks there can't get any books or movies on the subject. And in the schools in North Korea, they don't teach very much about space, aside from just a basic rundown of the planets, kind of like what we learned probably in elementary school. And they never go beyond that. They've sort of started a little bit, but he said they don't have any real interest, people in North Korea, in space. And as he sort of explained, It's the part of it is just the difficult life they lead over there, the hardships they face. I'll just read this quote from him. Most North Koreans spend morning to night concerned with how they can trade on the market to scrape by amid government-enforced compulsory labor. When do they have the time to take an interest in extraterrestrials? And it really kind of is a remarkable different world over there. Obviously, we all knew that, but still, it was sort of opened my eyes. It's never really considered this. And he said, if you walked up to a person in North Korea, they wouldn't even have the word UFO in their vocabulary. They wouldn't know what the word is.
And it's not even in their minds.
Right. And if you ask them about aliens, about extraterrestrials, they wouldn't. They have no opinion. They never give it a thought.
That is interesting. Interesting. They don't even discuss it in secret.
Yes, that was, yes, glad you pointed that out. That was a big part that jumped out to me, because as I was sort of going over the information, I was like, well, okay, maybe they're talking about it at home. No, this is what he says. Never talked about it with anybody when I was in school, and they don't talk about it in secret either. It's apparently just not something that they consider. It's really remarkable, especially when you consider the debates that go on over here and in the Western countries about UFOs and aliens and do they exist and is there a cover-up and stuff like that, and all the talk and it's all in the entertainment. And it's just remarkable that there's a place in the world where there's no debate over UFOs and aliens, because it just does not exist in their minds.
Fantastic. Great work, Tim, as always. Thanks for this.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
Tim Banal is the news editor for coasttocoastam.com and, of course, the host of the podcast Banal of America. All right. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak and a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Dr. Mark Mirabello is an author and a professor of history at Shawnee State University. He's also served as a visiting professor of history at Nizhny Novgorod University in Russia. Mark's area of expertise is the outlaw history of the front on the frontiers and margins of human civilization. He has a PhD from the University of Glasgow and a master's from the University of Virginia. He's the author of The Odin Brotherhood, now in its sixth edition, Handbook for Rebels and Outlaws, Resisting Tyrants, Hangmen, and Priests, and A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, Traditions and Beliefs on Death, Dying, and What Lies Beyond. And Mark is currently working on a new book. The working title is Secret Societies, A Skeleton Key. Dr. Mark Mirabello, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Dugard, sir, thank you for having me on the show. Now, notice what I just did. You have several million people in your audience. Most people would just ignore the verbiage, but the Masons out there would recognize Dugard as a token, as a symbol. And secret communications are fundamental to these orders, these fraternities. And incidentally, for the sexists out there, I'll be using he, because overwhelmingly secret societies are males only. And in fact, it seems as if when women are more serious, and when women are involved in secret societies, they tend to become more social clubs rather than, let's just say, put it this way, Skull and Bones, the infamous group from Yale University, at one time it was alleged that during their initiation, the initiate, it's been alleged, we can't prove it, would lie in a coffin, naked, and rehearse their sexual histories from basically masturbation in prep school on. Women were admitted to Skull and Bones starting in the 1990s. And I'll guarantee you they probably stopped the antics now that women are in it. And, of course, the Skull and Bones, they were accused of grave robbing and alleged they had Geronimo's skull. Also, some allegations they had Martin Van Buren, the president's skull, and also Pancho Villa. Again, we can't prove that. But now with women, these things will change. And when I open with statement of Dugard, if you're in a large group such as Freemasons, if you send the message you're a member, for example, you're applying for a job, you're applying for promotion, you're applying to medical school, you're applying to graduate school, you're applying to law school, if there's a Freemason, a Freemasonic person in the search committee, this will benefit you. Masons swear an oath that, now they have some weasel words in the oath, they must prefer Freemasons over other people of equal talents. If two people apply for a job, they must hire the Freemason. But in fact, I think the equal talents, that part is, again, shall we say, weasel words, because they'll probably prefer the Freemason. And when they do this, it's very important to remain secretive. As you mentioned, I'm at Shawnee State University, and if I'm on a search committee, again, I'm not a Mason, but if I were a Mason on a search committee, I would not tell other members of the search committee what I was doing. I would see a young person, young man show up. He has perhaps a Freemasonic ring. They don't have to hide their membership. They have secrets, but not that's not one of them. And he would give me perhaps a Master Mason handshake, and he would use special words during the interview that would indicate to me that he's a Freemason, and then I would hire him. I would promote him. But it's important to keep what I would be doing secret. It reminds me recently the mayor of Chicago, and incidentally, all of these groups are mutual aid societies. There's nothing wrong with promoting certain groups. And the mayor of society of Chicago, she announced that she was only going to be interviewed by African-American reporters. It caused this outrage, one-on-one interviews. You don't announce what you're doing. You basically do it secretly. What she should have done is simply invite these reporters and not announce it. So this is how Freemasons work. And there's groups such as the Triads, that's organized secret. Well, that's actually an underworld Chinese group, heavily involved in Taiwan, by the way. They also were involved in Sun Yat-sen, the first president of China, when they destroyed the Manchu dynasty and set up a new state, early 20th century, had connections to the Triads. Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Nationalist Party, who fled to Taiwan, he had connections to the Triads, and they permeate the economy, also overseas Chinese.
Right. So the purpose of a secret society is to, I guess, amass influence and power, right? But secret societies, we tend to think of them as sort of forming, you know, with the Freemasons and or stonecutters but you say that, and your research has led you to conclude that secret societies actually go back to prehistoric times.
Yes, we actually have. In fact, we found them in the 19th century among traditional cultures and legends, and there's really clear evidence that they go way back. In fact, the Mormons, who, by the way, in their endowment of power ceremonies, resemble secret society initiations. Enemies of the Mormons have said that they copied the Freemasons, but Joseph Smith Jr., the founder, the prophet of the Mormons, claimed that he was restoring the original stories, methods. And we do see in ancient Egyptian tombs what look like Freemasonic hand signals and even aprons on some of the characters in ancient Egyptian tombs. Well, the reason I mentioned the Mormons, they have a tradition that the first secret society goes back to the Garden of Eden. Cain formed it with Satan. And that, of course, there it has satanic connotations. But we do find them in traditional societies. And in fact, there's a really fascinating legend. It's so widespread, it must have some element of truth to it. We find it in Patagonia, South America, among the Aboriginal people of Australia. They tell the story of long, long ago, or as the Aboriginal people would say, the dream time, women dominated through magic. They could control death and sickness. And the men were under the thumb of the women. So the men got together in a conspiracy, and fundamentally secret societies are conspiracies. And the men got together in a conspiracy and murdered every female past the age of puberty, because when the initiations occurred, well, young girls were taught magical rituals at puberty, according to the traditions. So they murdered all the girls past puberty so that women lost the magical knowledge, and then men formed a secret society to control them, hence leading to male domination. So, and this myth is so widespread, there must be an element of truth. I should mention to your audience, because when I use the word myth, especially to Americans and Canadians, it's confusing because we immediately think of it as fiction. But in fact, I'm using it in the way, frankly, the Germans would use it. And it means a belief which helps you orient yourself in the universe. And it doesn't have to be true. It doesn't have to be false. It doesn't even matter if it's false.
All right, Mark, I've got to jump in here because we're going to take a quick timeout. We'll come back and continue with this primer on secret societies. Welcome back. Sitting in for George Norrie. A farmer in Minnesota was left scratching his head when a quarter-mile-long swath of his bean field mysteriously collapsed a staggering 25 feet and created an enormous ravine in the process. According to a local media report, the jaw-dropping development occurred on Wayne Erickson's farm near the community of Climax. He says, when I drove out there, it looked like the Grand Canyon, he marveled, noting that he and his wife had never seen anything quite like it in all their years working the land. And you can see more of this story, some video, and that's in the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. More of my conversation with Dr. Mark Mirabello as we discuss secret societies right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Dr. Mark Mirabello is with us. His, the new book he's working on is titled Secret Societies, A Skeleton Key. I wanted to ask you about the mafia, because technically, I guess they are a secret society. But you say that they have, since they came to North America, they've been compromised. How so?
That's actually really, I'm glad you asked about the mafia, because frankly, they are. And remember I said that there are two types, the overworld and the underworld. And, of course, what essentially happened is the mafia, starting in the 1970s, became so wealthy, mainly through drug dealing and so forth. And also they were involved in various things such as construction and so forth and protection rackets. They were corrupted by the wealth. One of the lectures I give on the fall of the Roman Empire, I talk about how wealth and power corrupts. As Lord Acton said at one level, power corrupts. And oddly enough, in the 1970s and 80s, they tried to import young men from Sicily because the Americans who grew up in New Jersey, New York, could not follow the rules. But they are, they're very small. There's about 3,000 made men. And by the way, if you're in a New York tavern or bar and some fellow is trying to impress a young woman and he says he's in the mafia, he's not. No real mafia member would ever admit that he's in it. In fact, they typically deny that it exists. And the reason they do this is because you have to kill to gain entry into the mafia. There's actually several secret societies. You mentioned up earlier the Leopard Men of West Africa. There are several secret societies where killing someone is part of the initiation process. And if you are in the mafia, you're called a made man, and you have a special initiation ritual. It typically involves cutting, among other things, it's more elaborate. They cut the trigger finger on the right hand, and then you rub, keep in mind they have a Roman Catholic cultural background, they rub the blood onto what is called a holy card. This is a card with a picture of a Roman Catholic saint, and typically a prayer on the back, and they swear these oaths, including even if you must even honor the mafia, and if your brother, if you're ordered to kill your brother, you must kill him. The mafia becomes all important in your life. You must blindly obey. And incidentally, the reason people do this is once you're in the mafia, endless wealth and power are yours. In fact, it's not just the money. Mafia men, when they walk into restaurants, they're immediately served first. They don't wait in line, and all the food is free. All the drinks are free. Their wives will dress in minks. It's free. People are afraid to charge the mafia. They call themselves the men of respect. And I should also mention a fundamental part of their rituals is what the Sicilians call omerta. I'm more or less butchering the Italian, even though I have an Italian last name. Omerta, which really means manliness at some level. And what it means is you are silent about the mafia, but also, for example, here's what Americans don't understand, and this is broken down in America, but not so much in Italy. If I'm a mafia person, not that I am, but if I were a mafia person, and I am falsely accused of a crime, and I go to prison, and I'm falsely accused, the mafia person will serve the sentence. He's showing manliness because he never cooperates with the police or the judicial system. ideally.
Right.
And he will serve the term, and then when he gets out, he will kill the person who sent him there. They view vendetta, it's called, as a personal pleasure. They don't use the law. They will take vengeance themselves. And incidentally, they have a myth. They claim they're fighting the occult power that rules the world. In other words, the Bilderbergers and the Trilaterals and the Skull and Bones and the Freemasons, they claim they're the ones that are fighting the occult power, the shadow governments, and so forth. And at some level, they are. And I should also mention a really interesting mafia, too, if you can call it, the term, are the Yakuza of Japan. Very powerful. They're much larger. There's probably, as I mentioned, 3,000 mafiosi in the United States. The Yakuza are probably about 90,000 members. And they openly, everyone knows who they are because they dress like men in black. They wear black suits, pointed black shoes. They wear sunglasses. They slick their hair back. Their bodies are covered in tattoos. The tattoo is interesting because in Japan, traditional Japan, tattoos were put on criminals. Ordinary people did not use tattoos. If you committed a certain crime, you'd have a tattoo on your face so that everyone knew you were a criminal. So what they're flaunting the fact. And incidentally, their name comes from a losing card game, a losing hand in a card game that resembles blackjack. And they draw heavily from, now, here's political correctness that you would not hear this typically. There's a class of people in Japan called the non-humans. Officially, in Japanese law, they don't exist. They passed laws in the 19th century outlawing this, but they still do exist. Japanese people won't let their daughters date them. They live in certain neighborhoods. They're discriminated against. And the Yakuza recruit heavily from these people. We don't know their origin. To us, they look like other Japanese, but they apparently are descended from people that served in taboo occupations, such as leather working that involved dead animals, executioners, and so forth. Some have suggested they were descended from Koreans who were brought into Japan, but they're of unknown origin. And when they join the Yakuza, they get wealth and unlimited power. Same thing with the mafia. By the way, the most powerful mafia now is the Italian version, the 'Ndrangheta in Calabria. They're far more powerful than the Sicilian mob. And they're all over the world. They're not just in Calabria now. They're in Germany, they're in the UK, the United States, they're in Canada, they're in Brazil, Argentina, and they're incredibly rich, incredibly powerful.
And tell me about the Order of Assassins, Mark. When did they begin?
Yes, that's a medieval, that's actually kind of interesting, the old Man of the Mountain story and so forth. It was understood that, and this is how wasteful wars are. We recently went through this. We claimed that invading Afghanistan to get bin Laden, it's far more intelligent to kill one person rather than send in armies, the person's troublemaker. And the assassin started in the medieval period it's a branch group, the Ismaili sect of Islam, and they swore special oaths and had levels of initiation and kept secrets. And it appears as if their higher oath was to serve the master of the order, to obey blindly. And they would go into deep cover, kind of like sleeper cells. And famously, one Christian prince was killed by these Muslims pretending to be Christian converts. And they were his friends and associates for years. And then typically, out of the blue, they would stab the victim and make no attempt to flee. They would be tortured, arrested, tortured, and killed, and made no attempt to flee. And although I should mention that targeted assassinations are far more common than people realize. And in fact, there's some, you could argue that many people that seem to go after secret societies seem to die unexpectedly in suspicious circumstances. Stephen Knight was a writer in Great Britain. Even if your audience hasn't heard of his name, they've heard of his work. He was the one that first tried to connect the Jack the Ripper murders with the Freemasons.
Right.
Pointed out that there's no doubt that whoever Jack the Ripper was using Freemasonic emblems at the crime scenes. By the way, the five bodies of the victims who were horribly mutilated make a big pentagram in London. It took years for people to notice that. And he was, for example, one site he left in blood, an inscription on the wall, "The Jews will not be blamed for nothing." Now, if you were unaware of Freemasonry, you may think that's an anti-Semitic statement, but it appears to refer to the three killers of Hiram, who is the architect of the Temple of Solomon, who was killed by three men who wanted the secrets of the treasure of Enoch. The story is Hiram found this treasure, which were these golden plates that gave a hidden history of the world and hidden information, and these three men tried to extort the information. He refused to give it to them, so they murdered him, and then they tried to hide the body. And then the story is King Solomon caught the murderers and killed them and buried them in a grave 6 feet by 6 feet by 6 feet. And the story is that, well, if you go through Freemasonic ritual, especially the third degree, Master Mason, it is in memory of the Hiram killing. And the oaths of the Freemasons take when they betray their oaths are from the way the three killers were killed. But at any rate, Stephen Knight, the official story is, you can look it up in Wikipedia, he died of brain cancer at a very young age. I think it was 28, and everybody closes the book. Maybe, but we know how to cause brain cancer. All you have to do is put some beryllium in someone's body, and a tumor will result at the location. You can do it through a medical examination. The doctor can insert some, wouldn't even notice. He's looking in your nasal passage, and he inserts the beryllium, and you're dead. Incidentally,
right. What about heart attack guns? We hear about heart attack guns that you can create a heart attack with somebody, and no one will ever know that was, you know, purposely done.
That's exactly true. And by the way, I should also mention that Jack Ruby, the person who on national television shot Oswald, he claimed he was murdered with cancer when he was dying. But on the heart attack gun, it's actually, strangely enough, it was revealed during the Frank Church hearings in the Senate. This was post-Watergate, and they were revealing some of the dirty tricks of the government. And they were really bizarre, some of them. They even had a plan, by the way, it never was carried out, to fake the second coming of Christ in Cuba. They were going to use this high-tech equipment to create a kind of image in the sky and loud sounds, and they thought because Castro had outlawed Christianity, that the people would rise up. But the heart attack gun, the projectile is a piece of ice, which has, and it's the size of a BB, and it was revealed that the CIA had developed it. This is not mafia. The CIA had developed it. Although, by the way, CIA in some respects resembles a secret society. But they had developed it for assassins. And when you use it, the projectile, the person who's hit by it, you could be walking down the street, you'd think you were stung by an insect. It'd be a slight little mark on your, for example, the back of your head. And then symptoms would resemble a heart attack, and you would drop dead on the sidewalk. And then the pellet melts, so no one would find. They would see what looks like a little insect bite, a little bit of blood, just a little bit of blood, almost nothing, and then the dead person. Now, technically, if you were to conduct a really serious autopsy, you could find the toxin, but they almost never do. People readily believe that cancer kills a lot of people, that heart attacks kill a lot of people, that strokes kill a lot of people. And in fact, there's been some allegations. Now, let me make it clear to your audience, do not go into anti-government mode and so forth. But it's really curious how, because it's dangerous, and it frankly, if you overthrow the government, it'll wreck us all. But how many people that go after the Federal Reserve, which conspiracy theorists call the Jekyll Island Group, because that's where it was secretly planned and then instituted into American law in 1913. Jekyll Island is an expensive resort island off the coast of Georgia. Mark Pittman was a journalist. He, early 21st century, was the first man to file a lawsuit against the Federal Reserve to open their books. Their books are never audited. And he dropped dead in his 40s walking down the sidewalk. And there have been allegations that this was done to him, although I don't know if it's true. I just share information. By the way, I should mention Congressman Lewis McFadden.
Yes, he delivered that great speech about the passage of that bill that created the Federal Reserve Bank.
Exactly.
Right?
You know your history, sir. And in fact, there were three attempts on his life. First, they used a gun. Then there was an attempt to poison him. And then the official story is he died of the flu. Okay, you can believe this one. He was vehemently opposed to the Federal Reserve. And incidentally, it is curious that anyone who seems to not only challenge our banking system, but also international banking system, 1930, they established the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, and it's completely free of all government control. It's not taxed. And essentially, they control the money supply. And if you're unaware how this works, Henry Ford famously said, if Americans understood how American banking worked, they would overthrow the system. If you borrow money, and by the way, the word mortgage means until death, roughly.
And lovely.
The Bible actually compares a debtor to a slave in the Old Testament. And historians would call this, the Vikings call it the gift thrall. That's when you voluntarily become a slave. Now, our culture can't imagine that. Slavery's become the ultimate evil, but people used to sell themselves into slavery, typically homeless people, people that were starving, because if you're a slave, you have a place to sleep, food to eat, and so forth, even though you could be whipped and have bad times. Well, any rate, Americans take on typically voluntary slavery, in which they borrow money, and they'll spend a quarter to a third of their lives paying off the debt. And the odd part is, the money you borrow doesn't exist.
That's right, created out of thin air.
Yes, and when you borrow it from a bank, it's created as a kind of entry, and they charge you interest on it. Here's the curious part. If you only made one mortgage payment, they still make a profit, technically, because the money's been made up.
All right, Mark, I've got to jump in here. We're approaching the top of the hour. We're going to take a timeout, come back. I want to talk about the different types. You say there are basically five different types, maybe six different types of secret societies. We'll also talk about a type of secret society that actually recruited young males who were dying from the White Death, which is tuberculosis. Mark Mirabello, my guest. And we'll continue to discuss secret societies right here on Coast to Coast. Back with more in a moment. Don't go away.